Welcome to The Dive, everybody. Thank you so much for joining me here yet again. Be sure to drop a like on this video, share this video. There's going to be a lot of truth in this conversation that you probably haven't heard before, especially if you haven't been following the real news surrounding the war in Ukraine and what's happening, you know, geopolitically with the United States right now. Because with me, I have Dmitry Polyansky again on our show. Very honored to have you back. Dmitry is the first deputy permanent representative of Russia to the United Nations. Dmitry, how are you today?
Not bad, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, the Ukrainian government, they put me on a kill list. So as good as I can be while being on a kill list of a foreign government.
That's an honor, you know. You have to deserve it.
Are you on that list yet?
Sure, for several years already. I think since I came here and I started to participate in the events, that time they were about Crimea. So we tried to bring some light on what's happening in Crimea to fight the propaganda that Ukraine was promoting. So since that moment, I got on this kill list. So I have already 5 years of experience.
Well, yeah, that list is crazy. They have like 13 and 14 year old girls on it. Like they have journalists.
Even younger. Yeah.
Really?
237 at least minors. That was discovered by our NGOs. Some of them are as young as 9 years, I think. So they could have been blacklisted only for example, entering Crimea from Russia. So if they came across on some social media that this or that person is taking a photo in Crimea and they assume immediately that he or she is violating Ukrainian laws, and it was enough to be put on this kill list and to have your personal data displayed, whatever data they could access from social media.
It's really crazy. I mean, and what's most insane, obviously, is that despite the fact that American citizens, journalists are being put on this kill list, you know, the United States government continues to funnel hundreds of billions of dollars to their government and their military and their Nazi paramilitary groups. Which brings me to a good point here for my first question for you. I just saw a stat that nearly 70% of the global population either lives in neutral or pro-Russia, Russia-leaning countries right now. And, you know, looking a year back since the start of the Russian special military operation, how have things changed diplomatically for Russia, specifically for you and your job and what you have to do each and every day at the United Nations? Have you seen more countries become, you know, open to the idea of working with you, understanding what's really happening with Russia right now, or has the opposite happened?
Well, the difference is striking. A year ago, I think many countries were taken aback, overwhelmed by the development of the events. They didn't have much time to dig deeper, and that's why the initial moves of our former Western colleagues on the UN platform were quite successful. So they managed to promote very, I would say, critical decisions and a lot of formulas that were totally one-sided, anti-Russian, and absolutely shallow in terms of Ukrainian conflict as such. But then, with the pace of time, more and more countries started to ask the question, why is it happening? Why has it happened? Why would Russia all of a sudden launch this special military operation? So they have started to listen to our arguments on the one hand. On the other hand, of course, they were seeing that Western countries were part of this conflict, because very, very quickly it has become obvious that it's not Russia and Ukraine that are fighting in Ukraine right now. It's a NATO proxy war against Russia with the hands of the Ukrainians until last Ukrainian with Ukrainian blood. And now they are, I think some of the US politicians and senators were just floating this idea openly. It's a big advantage of US that they are fighting geopolitical enemy and no US blood is shed, something like this. I don't remember the exact quote. So again, there was a chance for peaceful settlement of the whole story when Ukraine made some proposals, diplomatic proposals, which could have become a basis for diplomatic settlement for us to achieve all the aims of our special military operation by diplomatic way. That was the option that we always preferred. But immediately there were voices from Washington and London telling Ukrainians to withdraw their proposal, because that was not in the interest of London and Washington to have this whole crisis end so quickly and with a positive result for Russia. They want to weaken Russia. It's part of their political, geopolitical game. And they are not interested whatsoever in ending this conflict. And then they started to fan the conflict, to fan up the conflict by supplying weapons, by supplying armaments to Ukraine. And so everybody in UN is now seeing this and asking, look, guys, you are supplying weapons to Ukraine. Ukraine has squandered several armies already. We don't know how many people died. And you are fanning up the conflict. So how can you really be doing this and pretending that you are interested in peace? So more and more countries are asking these questions, more actively in the couloir, because Western countries have immense possibilities of pressing those countries who try to pursue independent policy. But nevertheless, for Western bloc, it has become harder and harder to promote decisions of the same magnitude, I would say, of the same sharpness that it was at the initial stage of our special military operation. And the illustrative, very illustrative development has happened recently during the latest edition of this 11th special emergency session on Ukraine, which was resumed. And the resolution that they promoted, it was so watered down from the initial expectations of Ukrainians and the Westerners. So with some, really, with some amendments that Belarus was proposing, I think we could even have supported it, because it's so toothless on a lot of issues. So they wanted figures. They wanted figures, and they got still a little bit less than they were hoping to. It was enormous hand twisting and blackmailing, some procedural, I would say, procedural slyness was displayed in the whole thing. But they managed to get a text, which is far, far from their expectations. And even President Zelensky, I think, was not aware of this, of the contents of this resolution, because he was saying, if I'm not mistaken, to an Italian colleague on the eve of the vote, that General Assembly is about to endorse his peace plan. But his peace plan was excluded there because a lot of countries saying, no, we will not support Zelensky's peace plan because it's not constructive, it's only ultimatum. And this peace plan was deleted, again, to get more votes. And, well, it's harder and harder of them for Western countries to push this agenda, anti-Russian agenda, because countries are starting to ask questions, countries are starting to see who is interested in peace and who is not interested to peace in peace. And, of course, we also try to promote the information about the root causes of what has happened, what were the reasons of our special military operation. More and more information is coming about what has been happening in Donbas during these 8 years that preceded special military operation. All this in combination create a very uncomfortable, I would say, a mixture for our Western colleagues and make their work, their propaganda work, more and more difficult. And this is visible. That's how I feel the changes that happened during this year. So they claim that Russia is isolated. They still say it's kind of, you know, a must be a speaking point for all of their intervention. But de facto, they themselves are isolated. There are 70 countries which are really having bloc discipline, and they are promoting this Russophobic agenda. Everything else, everybody else is, I would say, to put it mildly, stunned, reluctant, asking questions, siding with Russia, being neutral, not voting. So the landscape has changed very much during this year.
Mm-hmm. It is 100% propaganda. And I mean, it's awkward, as you put it. I mean, look at German Chancellor Olaf Scholz going and meeting with Joe Biden, and not a single journalist is allowed to ask a question about the Nord Stream pipeline terror attack. I mean, how is Russia dealing with that right now at the United Nations? Because this is obviously something that needs to have a full investigation. Anonymous intelligence officials cited in the New York Times claim a pro-Ukraine group was responsible for this. I happen to believe the CIA and the State Department qualify as pro-Ukraine groups, but what is Russia's take on this? How are you approaching this at the United Nations?
Well, first and foremost, you know that we asked for a special meeting on Nord Stream. Actually, there were two meetings. One was in September, immediately after the sabotage act was committed. Second was after Seymour Hersh published his information. We found out that this information was really worth asking for a Security Council meeting because it's extremely detailed. It gives answers to almost all the questions: who did it, when, why, how. So it's more than a smoking gun. And knowing Seymour's reputation, it's very hard to believe that this time, one time in his life, he decided to lie. I think at his age, he would think not twice, but 20 times before committing such an error. So for us, it was enough to look at this from different angle. We were quite patient. You know that there is a national investigation. There are national investigations in several countries, namely in Denmark, Sweden, and Germany. And we are not being involved in this investigation, not because we don't want to, but because they keep us at bay. They are denying any access to information. They are denying any participation, regardless of the fact that we are an affected party. So we should be part of this investigation, but they are just writing to us some letters saying that we are doing what we are doing and mind your own business. That's kind of in a nutshell what they are replying to us. To be transparent, we will publish this whole correspondence quite soon and distribute it among the members of the Security Council. So we say we wanted to tell our colleagues in Security Council that, guys, that given this information, we need independent, unbiased international investigation with all parties concerned being there. And we trust Secretary General. So let's charge Secretary General to prepare proposals for an independent investigation. That's the core of our idea, which is now being discussed among members of the Security Council. We shaped it in the form of resolution, draft resolution. But, well, you wouldn't be surprised that a number of countries, namely Western countries, they don't want to participate in this work. So they have to, they are sending experts, but these experts are just saying we don't see any need in this kind of investigation at this part. So it's really a game. And, well, the recent information, I wouldn't dwell into too much details. I think it's too obvious that this is really likely to be an attempt to divert attention from really what has happened. And there are a lot of ridiculous things there. Again, I don't want to go into the detail. I tweeted immediately when this information was published that, okay, keep putting aside the contents of what has been disclosed, it still confirms the necessity of international investigation. And that's what we are promoting at the Security Council, and I think we're really doing the right thing, and it's the right of not only Russia but everybody to understand what has happened, because this is the very extreme act of sabotage, which can imply a lot of things, which can change international relations for years to come. Because if we are approaching the age when we can attack infrastructure projects of everybody with such a magnitude, then I don't know what will be the limits of this terrible time that we are entering. We don't want to do it. That's why we want all the culpable actors to be held accountable. I think that's quite justifiable in any circumstances, and in our circumstances as well. But as I told you, the expert work is not progressing very well, so we are patient. We have conducted three rounds of expert consultations, but at some point, likely by the end of March, we will put this text to vote. And again, I would not be surprised if Western countries will just try to pretend that this is excessive and we don't need it, and the information is not reliable, and so on and so forth. So you know how they're applying double standards in the situation when this is not in their favor.
You talk about, you know, we don't know what the limits are here. Who knows what could happen? Aside, you know, take away the politics, take away everything. As a human being, are you worried that the West is on the path of escalating what is currently a proxy war against Russia into a hot war, into a world war? I mean, and I say that with intent, because it is the West. You know, for anyone listening who hasn't been following this, again, it is the West that has started this, not this, this, you know, fighting didn't start on February 24th of 2022, started long before that, when Ukraine lost their sovereignty. So are you worried about that?
I think every person on the on our earth should be worried about what is happening. And of course, I'm worried as everybody else. I don't really see the logic in what the West is doing. I see the logic in terms of playing against Russia. But I think we're entering some very slippery slope where it is much more than, you know, doing bad things to Russia, because NATO is becoming more and more directly implied. There are more and more sophisticated types of weapons supplied to Ukraine, and we know that many of these types they require direct involvement of either operators or controllers. So the Ukrainians can't operate it themselves, and they acknowledge it. It means that when Ukrainians hit certain targets in Donetsk region, like hospital, for example, it means that NATO is behind this. And again, without this long-range artillery or rocket systems, they wouldn't have targeted, be successful in targeting this or that building. So it makes United States and its allies directly involved. There are a lot of mercenaries. There are a lot of, I don't know, thousands already of mercenaries who have already been killed in Ukraine, fighting for Ukraine, and many of them are army officers, well prepared, and it's quite clear that their absence from military service in their countries is a temporary diversion of their career. So we have repeatedly said that this kind of situation is not acceptable, and of course it implies that there will be no business as usual from our part in relations to the West. We have lost completely the trust in anything that the West is doing, saying, or I don't know, proposing. Of course, there was not very much trust after they cheated us in the 90s. It was not very much trust after they cheated us with NATO invasion, enlargement. So now, of course, we have absolutely no trust left after the infamous confessions of Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Hollande and Boris Johnson about Minsk agreements, that that was nothing but a smokescreen, behind which they just were preparing Ukraine for a war with Russia. Mm-hmm. They said it openly, and this is of course killing any remainder of trust which was there. So the question is how to form relations with the West at this stage post special military operation. But we need to go there. So far, there are a lot of voices, a lot of people, including, of course, the Ukrainians, who would be, I mean, Ukrainian regime, who would be very much interested in direct implication of NATO, direct involvement, because this is the only chance for Zelensky regime to survive, to get direct involvement in NATO. You remember that he tried two or three times to provoke NATO with this missile in Poland, which turned out to be Ukrainian missile, and nobody has still been held accountable for this. But he was saying that Russia has attacked Poland. So please enact Article 5. This was very dangerous. And nobody even criticized him for that, for being so reckless with this. So there are several politicians that promote their approaches from the United States and from Europe, saying that we need to get implied, we need to fight, we need to send armies. And you understand that this is the beginning of World War III, because we are speaking about trying to defeat a nuclear power. I don't know whether these people who propose these things are really sane, whether they understand the consequences of all this. I have doubts sometimes. That's why, of course, I'm worried. I'm not worried because of what my country is doing. I'm worried because there are a lot of insane people from the part of the West who are not really weighing properly their words. What they are, what they're doing is criminal. What they're saying is criminal. And I felt that already throughout this time that there are a lot of people, intellectuals in the world who are really very much worried that their destiny is in the hand of some crazy Western politicians who absolutely don't care about the world. They care about their own dirty political interests. And you remember this Security Council meeting where Roger Waters was speaking. He tried to reflect the voices, the positions of this majority, but silent majority that is not being given opportunity to express its opinion, that is being led by some kind of shepherds, and these shepherds really have their own interests. So he tried to present this case in the council, saying that, look, guys, we are very, very worried, and we know that something wrong might happen, and we don't want this to happen. And there are a lot of indicators that the West is not willing really to accept the realities, and they want to escalate the situation. They want to send new and new arms. Now there was a decision on tanks, which will not, of course, change the situation on the battlefield. Then some people are speaking about planes. I don't know whether this is real or not, but planes will imply a lot of things, and it might imply direct involvement of NATO countries for maintenance, for airfields, because there are not so many airfields in Ukraine that can be used for this. So imagine that these planes are starting from Poland, entering the Ukrainian air, and go back to Poland for maintenance. Will Poland be involved in this case? I think so. Direct involvement. So too many questions and too little reasoning from the West. I would say too much of neglect for the destiny of their own countries, of our whole planet, which of course will be endangered in case of major conflict. That really worries me a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as it does for me, definitely. And one thing that that also really worries me is the threat of Nazism. And after World War II, I think people from the Soviet Union made a very, very good effort to try and eradicate Nazism. And as a result of many factors, the fall of the Soviet Union, what took place with the West at the Nuremberg trials, they were trying to be more lenient with these, prosecutions. Nazism has again risen to the surface in Ukraine. So what are Russia's goals for this special military operation and potential legal proceedings after the end of this special military operation, insofar as trying to make sure that for the last time Nazism is eradicated and it doesn't resurface like we're seeing right now in Ukraine?
Well, I will maybe simplify a little bit, but the main reason why, there are two main reasons why we started this special military operation. One of them, and I think the most important and urgent one, was the destiny of the residents of Donbas, who were facing constant shellings and whose life were in danger for 8 years. So we wanted to put a stop to this situation. We had some hope for the Minsk agreements, but now we know that this was just a hoax from the West, and it was not serious from the part of Ukraine. So we lost quite a lot of time and a lot of lives. This is deplorable. And we had to intervene from this point of view. The other thing is that after this anti-constitutional Maidan coup in 2014, which was committed with a big involvement of Western countries, as we all know, especially the United States, on our borders, instead of a good friendly neighbor, we had a hornet's nest, Russophobic and neo-Nazi hornet's nest. So we were hoping that this was a mistake, that at some point of time somebody will really tell these people, look, guys, this is not becoming in our time to behave like this. It's not becoming to worship former German collaborators like Bandera and Shukhevich. So we were really hoping that there will be common sense in the West to stop all this madness. But nobody did it. They just showed that whatever was happening in Ukraine, if it was against Russia, then it's okay for the West. And that was as simple as this. So the second objective of our special military operation is to have again at our borders a normal, peace-loving neighbor who would be ready to live in peace with us and who will not worship Nazi criminals and who would not discriminate Russian speakers because they are Russian speakers, who would not do foolish things with Russian language, which is still native language for majority of Ukrainians, in the same way that it is being done. I mean, respect for other minorities in Europe, in Belgium, in Switzerland, I don't know, in Canada. So can you imagine such discriminative things happening in other places? And this is the real concrete discrimination because of people using other language. So Ukraine was de facto transformed into anti-Russia, and that was the only reason of this state to exist. And now we see that it was not accidental. That was done by purpose, because the West needed this anti-Russia to provoke us and to weaken us. And we don't want to have anti-Russia at our borders. And it's not about, as some people claim, that we want to do away with Ukraine as a country and to Russify Ukraine, to get rid of Ukrainian language. This is all not true. There were never such objectives. We have nothing against Ukraine. We have nothing against Ukrainian language. There are a lot of Ukrainians living in Russia, and they also use their language. In Crimea, we have Ukrainian language as an official language since Crimea rejoined Russia. We have nothing about this. We want to have respect and equality for everybody, for all the nationalities. And unfortunately, the Ukrainian state that existed after the Maidan was doing quite the opposite thing. And I also want to point out to one more element, which is usually not in the limelight when people are speaking about Ukrainian nationalism, because it's not limited to worshiping German fascism and to worshiping those who were collaborating with Hitler. Ukrainian Nazism has history of its own. It has history dating back to 1920s when it was created for political reasons and targeted initially against Poland, but then it was easily reoriented towards Russia. And the essence of this nationalism is the same as German fascism. So it's exceptionalism of Ukrainian nation, Ukraine über alles, Ukraina ponad usse, as they are saying. All these things, like people are saying Slava Ukraini, and the reply, it's a Nazi thing. In fact, so all who are repeating this, they are repeating Nazi slogans. It was all already based on Ukrainian Nazism itself. And when they had German Nazis invading Soviet Union, they became natural allies. They had hopes of getting their own state. And that's why they were cooperating so well at the beginning, and they were so ardent in committing heinous atrocities in Ukraine. Even the Germans were appalled, as we know from some memoirs about how cruel Ukrainian nationalists were towards Jews, Russians, Ukrainians themselves, and Poles. But then they understood that Hitler was not very very keen on granting independence to this Ukrainian state, that they needed all the Slavic nations as slaves and nothing more, and they wanted their land. Then they started to kind of have divisions with the fascists, and then Bandera was arrested, and all the others were criticizing Germans, but their hands were already in blood completely, and they are responsible for so many atrocities at this stage. And what is so shameful, to finish this topic, is that after the defeat of Nazi Germany and after all these elements were pushed away from Ukraine, a lot of them found refuge in the West and in the United States. And that's from where this revived spirit of Ukrainian nationalists came from after Ukrainian independence. And it was very difficult to implant this absolutely foreign element for Soviet Ukraine, for Soviet Ukrainian people. So they were not succeeding in doing it in 1991. They had to gradually prepare Ukrainian society for this kind of transformation. It was easy to do in Baltic states, which are very small and where the elites were living from quite a long time together, and they just had to change the elite of these states, and the whole states became Russophobic very quickly. But Ukraine hasn't become Russophobic very quickly. It was kind of meticulous work, ardent work done by a lot of countries to change Ukraine from a peace-loving neighbor where Russian speakers have equal right with Ukrainian speakers to some kind of anti-Russia. So we want to change this thing. We don't want to have this neighbor. And I think not a single country in the world would like to see such a neighbor at their borders. Would the United States like to see Canada becoming anti-US, or French speakers taking over English speakers and saying that they can speak only French right now? I don't think that the United States will be happy. And at some point of time, especially if foreign countries are involved there, and at a certain time, it will result in something similar. So that's why I think that those who want really to understand the reasoning, they should just imagine this situation from our optics, from our perspective, how we feel in this situation. And we don't have any aims of destroying Ukraine, of destroying Ukrainian nations. That's why we're not speaking about the war. We're speaking about special military operation against the criminal Kyiv regime, who has hijacked its own country. And the moment we do away with this diplomatically or militarily, I think all the problems will end. Hopefully we will not get into some very bad development because of the stubbornness of our Western countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think any rational person looking at the situation understands what's going on and can say that, you know, they stand with Russia. And one last question, if I may, if you have a few words. I love your tweets. You always say "not my values" when you tweet out the insane Western degeneracy and just like, I don't even know what's happening. It's a civilizational collapse in the West right now that we're witnessing. A few words maybe you might have for those in the West who are trying to fight back against it and uphold what it means to be an American or, you know, part of this culture.
Well, I would say that we're quite tolerant people in Russia. We don't mind if people in other places want to live the way they live. It's up to you to choose how you live, whom you consider a man or a woman, how many genders. Do you have how many men menstruate in your country? It's up to you to choose. But please don't impose these values on us, because we live in a different way. We do not support these values. We are supporting normal families. We are supporting children. We are supporting men being men and women being women. It doesn't mean that there are no gays in Russia, that there are no lesbians in Russia. There are, of course. But we just don't want this trend to be kind of dominating, and for this minority, for this crazy minority to dominate the whole of the society. When we are adopting laws, we are adopting laws, not anti-gay laws, but we are adopting laws against the gay propaganda, because we think that if the children from the outset are being treated in the way that people are asking them the questions, don't rush that you're a boy. Think twice. Let's wait until you are 14, and then we will give you certain medicaments, yes, to kind of preserve you in the way you are without not developing into a man or a woman, and then you will decide. This is criminal. Mm-hmm. I think this is criminal, and I hope that nothing like this ever happens in my country. That's why I'm tweeting these things, and I'm openly saying that these are not my values. If you want to do it. It's up to you, but don't try to bring this thing to the whole world. Have respect to the others, and I think it's anomaly, this kind of behavior, sometimes criminal anomaly, but I don't make my judgment, and I don't say that, well, guys, you don't need to behave in the way you behave. I'm just saying that it's not my values. And I know that a lot of people, and including in this country, are also saying this. But the problem is that saying this in this country has become very dangerous. You can criticize Russia, you can do whatever you want, but if you just say, some professor somewhere would say that I am anti-gay, for example, or I think that there are only two sexes on the planet, so then he or she is in danger. Mm-hmm. And that's also a problem, this kind of dictature of this approach. I don't think it's really normal. For me, it's weird, to put it mildly.
It is weird, and it's not a lot of our values either. So hopefully we fight back against that. Dmitry Polyansky, thank you so much for joining me here on The Dive. It's been a pleasure, and I'll have your Twitter account, everything linked below for everyone to follow you, because you are a great follow on Twitter. You're doing amazing work, and thank you for fighting for peace.
Thank you. All the best to you, Jackson.
Thanks for watching that episode of The Dive. If you enjoyed what you saw, be sure to drop a like, subscribe, comment below, and be sure to share this video with your friends. Also, my YouTube channel has now been permanently demonetized by YouTube because of the truth that we tell here. For that reason, I'm asking you to join as a supporter on my Locals community, which you can find linked below in the description of this video or in the comment section. When you join as a donor on Locals, you get access to my weekly private live streams, all of my private content, and the opportunity to ask questions to the guests that I bring here on our show, such as Glenn Greenwald, Colonel Douglas McGregor, and Ron Paul. Thanks for watching. Thank you for your support. I'll see you back here next time.